Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. Last week, the progressive movement powered a blue wave across the country that swept progressives and Democrats into offices previously unobtainable, including a number of House seats that's greater than any midterm election since at least the Nixon administration. Today, to talk about the actual statistics and what we can learn from the numbers out of the election, I have with me Mark Grebner, well-known among Michigan political insiders as perhaps the best analyst of Michigan polling numbers and election statistics. Mark, thanks for coming on. And I want to talk to you today about what happened this election. Let me just start from a sort of a broad perspective. What do you, from your perspective in the numbers, what do you see that happened this election?
Well, thanks for inviting me to talk here. A lot of things happened. Obviously, you can start at the beginning and say the Democrats won a bunch of things they weren't winning before. On the other hand, the Republicans still control both houses of the legislature. The Republicans still have half the seats in Congress. It's not as if this was a rout, but the Democrats have been in such a weak position that where we are today looks a lot better to us. I'm a lifelong Democrat, so I speak of we. So in the first place, Democrats did a lot better, but there's a structure to the changes. The Michigan electorate is changing. The if you think of a map, geographic map, but also a demographic map, we're just seeing real shifts that some segments are becoming much more liberal and democratic. Some segments are remaining very conservative, maybe even shifting toward Republican and conservatism. And I don't think people really appreciate the extent to which the map, both physical and demographic, is shifting. Maybe I'd talk about some of those. One of the things that we're seeing is that rural areas, many of which have been ancestrally Democratic in their orientation, are just off the table for the Democratic Party. They are becoming very Republican, even compared to 2, 4, and 6 years ago. But there are a lot of counties that had Democratic sheriffs and Democratic traditions and Democratic boards of commissioners, say Alpena County or most of the Upper Peninsula, and the Democrats just are getting wiped out. Democrats actually lost a state representative seat in the middle of winning a net of 5 seats. They actually lost a seat that no one, not even the Republicans, were looking at, in, way off in the western edge of the UP, because those little low population counties, the Democrats are just disappearing. What's really happening is they're converting themselves to being Republicans.
So a couple of questions about that. So first of all, one of the things you said was that the Democrats still didn't manage to take either house of the state legislature. They did pick up 5 seats in each of the houses, and they're now they went from being down by, what is it, eight and a bunch. I can't remember the exact numbers, but they're now down by 3 in each house, or 3 in the House and 4 in the Senate.
Roughly.
And so my first question is, looking at, I mean, when I looked at the the data on the state legislature races, it looks like a lot more of them are very gerrymandered. I mean, as we know, they're very, very gerrymandered after 2010. But I mean, some of them are like winning by 87% or something like that. In some districts. So first of all, I guess my first question is, how much of the fact that the Democrats didn't win back either of the houses of the legislature, how much of that is due to gerrymandering, and how much of that is due to some of the shifts in the electorate that you're talking about?
Well, the shifts, there are a number of others I was going to go through, and I probably will cover in the rest of our program, but they go both ways. I mean, the Republicans are picking up in rural areas, but the Democrats are picking up in urban areas, and of course, there are more urban and suburban areas than rural. So we're seeing a lot of shifts, But the Republicans drew these districts mm-hmm. in 2010 mm-hmm. with the specific intention that they would survive a flood of a certain height.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of this as like a tidal wave, a tsunami
yep.
coming on shore, and you don't try to you don't have different heights of your flood wall.
Right.
You know, if you're going to get overwhelmed, you might as well lose everything, is the theory.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You see, build it all to about the same height. Well, the height that they built it for was roughly this election,
mm-hmm.
and it held.
Mm.
So without their gerrymander, the Democrats would have picked up additional seats
mm-hmm.
and probably in one or both houses would have won enough
mm-hmm.
to take control of the House,
sure.
which is tremendously important. It's not just there are 56 Democrats mm-hmm. and 54 Republicans. If you have 56 seats, it means that you appoint you elect the speaker,
right.
all the committee chairs, you control all the legislation,
sure.
you hire the staff,
mm-hmm.
and
you saw the thing about the staff differential, right? That the Republicans are getting like twice as much money to each Republican is getting like twice as much money in the state Senate and twice as many staff and the resources for twice as many staff as Democrats. So that's a
right.
huge disparity,
right? But they also control the flow of bills.
Sure.
So control of the chamber is the critical thing. It's not just having a certain number. It's 54 seats is not that much better than 52 seats.
Right.
But 56 seats is a lot different than 54.
Sure.
Because
right.
it means that
right.
suddenly you control the
right.
process.
Right.
Well, the Republicans drew these seats for the purpose of surviving a Democratic majority
right.
in the vote.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't seen the numbers, but I imagine the Democrats took about 53 or 54% of the statewide vote
sure.
for state representative mm-hmm. and for state Senate.
Mm-hmm.
But we take 54% of the seats of the votes and we end up with a minority in the
right.
legislature.
Right.
The Republicans get 46% of the
sure.
seat of the votes, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And they win.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's why they opposed Proposal 2, because what a wonderful system, they said.
Mm-hmm.
This you don't even have to get a majority to win. You
right.
just get a minority, and
right.
and the system, you know, awards you the first place prize.
Right. So I mean, I think that's absolutely why I would argue that's why gerrymandering was written into the laws. I mean. One of the things coming out of the Revolutionary War and between the period where they had a more federalist kind of a constitution, one of the things that the founders talked about was they were concerned with the amount of influence that people had over their legislators, and they wanted to give their legislators more control over the people, and that's one of the reasons I think that gerrymandering is in there, and it's certainly been used that way since the first election following the new constitution in 1788. Of course, you know, gerrymandering was the term was coined in 1812, just 24 years after the constitution, and had been used, you know, since 1790.
Yeah, Elbridge. So, Gary is how
right.
he pronounced his name.
Right.
Had just the nicest map of Boston election districts.
Yeah.
And he has been immortalized ever since. He's been forgotten as a politician,
right.
but his name lives forever.
Right. Yeah. So yes, I agree with you that they built this to withstand this kind of a push. And to maintain minority rule, which I think is anti-democratic. I don't majoritarianism isn't democratic either, but minority rule is certainly undemocratic.
I think that any democratic system, if there's a government to control, the majority of the voters are supposed to control it. I don't think that that's anti-democratic.
Well, what I mean by that is that you cannot if that's the only criteria, I think it has to be a key criteria. But if that's the only criteria, you don't end up protecting minorities, and you end up in a situation where 50 plus one 50% plus one gives you the ability to do anything that you want, and that's a problem. That's why we need to have rights in a constitution. But also, I think that there are dynamic systems that could be in place to handle that. That's a more theoretical discussion. Maybe we'll get into a little bit later. I want to get back to the statistics.
I would just say though that there have to be limits on government power.
Sure,
but really, the majority of the public, the majority of the voters, the majority of any system you've got is supposed to be in charge, and it's not supposed to be run by the minority.
I absolutely agree. There's no
democratic system that way lies monarchy, right?
Right. I mean, absolutely.
If winning most of the votes doesn't get you anything,
right,
then it's not really a democracy.
Right. No, I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. That's why I think it's the prima facie case is that we don't have a democracy and we're not designed to have a democracy. Now we're still fighting to try to have one.
I'd say it's an imperfect democracy, but go ahead.
I understand. A lot of people say that. We'll get into that some more. I want to go back to what you said about the statistics. I agree with you that they built the particular districts in order to try to raise a wall against this kind of a wave. But the facts on the ground also limit how high a wall they could build.
Right.
Okay. I think that this demonstrates the importance of Prop 2, because obviously they were able to build a wall that if we weren't able to redistrict in a nonpartisan way, given their control of the legislature because of their partisan redistricting, if we weren't able to do that, it would take us longer to build up the numbers to overcome that wall. But I think, you know, Prop 2 is going to change that. What do you think the results are going to be in a Prop 2 era for Michigan?
Well, in the first place, Prop 2 completely changes the game of drawing districts.
Sure.
It's going to be just a different game. And it's going to be so different that things are going to happen that nobody expects now. That independent commission is going to be more independent than anybody expects. The experience in both Pennsylvania and Arizona was that all the participants outside the redistricting commission stood around with their mouths open and said, "What? What? What?"
Right.
And there's no reason to think that the 13 people who are not yet selected, who don't even imagine who they'll be,
right,
no one can know that they will be chosen for it, right?
Sure.
It's completely,
right,
there's no way to manipulate this to get into it. Somewhere, 13 people who are already living in Michigan or already voters are going to be on that commission. And God knows what
they might
do.
Not actually already be voters, because we're not going to have the commission at the earliest until 2020, as long as they're registered by that time. So
I guess I'll bet you there aren't any 19-year-olds on the commission, but we'll see.
Right.
In any case, it's likely to just be a surprise to everybody. From the Democratic side, a surprise is better than what we got, because what we've been getting for the last 20 years has not been a surprise. We've just been getting shellacked.
It can't be entirely a surprise, because the commission does have a set of rules that it has to follow, and it has to follow them in a particular order of priority.
The rules are vaguely enough stated, and the courts are going to give enough deference to that body that whether East Lansing is connected to Meridian Township or Clinton County, those are two very different districts for East Lansing, just for example. And one of them is extremely safe and boring, and one of them puts East Lansing into a very competitive and difficult struggle for control of the seat. And there are 110 such seats,
right,
and there are going to be 110 such surprises. There are going to be seats that are, who knows, there may be a seat drawn that has five members of the legislature all living in the same boundaries.
Sure.
There may be 20 seats or 30 seats drawn in 2022 that have no incumbents, where nobody imagined that there was an open seat, and there you are living in, say in the city of Detroit, and you happen to wake up one morning and find that you live in a legislative seat that has no incumbent and no strong candidate.
That actually could happen to every legislative seat, because when you redraw the districts in from one that's really designed for a specific purpose to one that's designed to be fair, or at least nonpartisan, I think that it's entirely possible that.
Well, East Lansing, as long as the incumbent lives in East Lansing and East Lansing isn't divided,
sure,
East Lansing will have an incumbent. But
right.
But the point is that there will be cities where
right.
all the incumbents are in one district and
right.
the other district is like
right.
incumbent free.
Right.
My point is simply, we don't know what's going to come out of it.
Right.
The one thing that we know is the Republicans won't control it.
Right.
We can also say the Democrats won't control it.
Right.
And that there are a whole lot of incumbents who are going to find themselves
sure.
very unhappy with the results. And they're going to try to pull strings. They're going to find out the strings that they pull are not connected to anything.
Right, right, right. So that's it seems to me, just looking at the way that the map is right now and looking at the margins in the very gerrymandered districts that allow a minority to actually win a majority of seats, I think that it seems to me fairly implausible that you would get a nonpartisan map that wouldn't have the effect of flipping the legislatures, assuming the same kind of demographics that we've seen several cycles.
Even. If you mean that if the Democrats take 53% of the statewide vote,
mm-hmm.
they're going to control the legislature.
Yes,
I think. That would be probably 80 or 90% chance of winning the legislature
sure.
under a randomly drawn map.
Right.
And so if the map is more or less randomly drawn, mm-hmm. Say not under anybody's control,
sure.
this kind of a win by the Democratic Party will mean Democratic control of both the House and Senate.
Right.
And so the Republicans look at it and say, well, but what don't we get something for our 47%? Why can't we control the legislature? And the answer is, well, you got maybe a 10 or 20% chance of winning the legislature, even with 47, but you better not slip below 47. And, you know, my suspicion is they may be slipping below 47 for the next 10 or 20 years.
Why do you think that is? Well, actually, I want to come back to why you think that is. But before we go there, I want to talk about the other prop that passed related to voting rights that could also have an impact. What do you think the impact of Prop 3 will be?
Prop 3 implements a bunch of, like a grab bag of liberalizations of voting, and they've all been tried in other states.
I would call them democratizations of voting, by the way, because a lot of people, I want to speak to conservatives and Republicans and say, look, it's not about liberal or conservative, it's about democracy.
Well, I speak of liberalization meaning like freeing of.
So an
individual can vote even if X. So an individual
right.
can vote even if Y. And
right.
individual isn't barred from voting because they made the mistake of doing Z.
Right.
You know? So,
right. No, I agree with you. I've had enough of these conversations with conservatives that I want to talk. I want to emphasize to them that's the case.
That they're going to let lots of conservatives who. Have been barred from voting because they move a lot and
mm-hmm.
as if that's a major problem for them. Yes. And those 19-year-old conservatives will all be encouraged to vote and so
right.
on. So many as there are of 19-year-olds. So I'm still going to call it liberalization
that's
of voting.
Yeah, sure.
But they've all been tested in other states, and so we know roughly what their impact is.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to really change how elections are conducted in Michigan. It's also going to change the way the campaigns think.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, the voter list. I'm fundamentally a voter list guy.
Right.
I live and breathe the structure and mathematics of
sure.
voter lists. The voter list now is a list of people eligible to vote. It's the list. And if you're not on the list, then you can't vote, and you have to get on the list in order to vote. Well, now that Proposal 3 has passed, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
If I find a person walking the earth, and it's election day in 2020,
mm-hmm.
and that person isn't on the voter list,
mm-hmm.
so what?
Right.
If I can get that person to City Hall,
mm-hmm.
they can, if they're 18 years old and a citizen,
mm-hmm.
and they live in East Lansing, say, or they live in Lansing, or they live in Mason,
right,
they can vote.
Right.
And so the person who I don't know
right.
is suddenly the best GOTV target, best get-out-the-vote target.
Mm-hmm.
The person whose name I don't know, the person whose political history I only learned by talking to him on a street corner,
mm-hmm.
I can now get him to vote.
Right.
For MSU students, the problem has always been that they moved to East Lansing, especially freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to East Lansing, and 28 or 32 days later is the end of voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've only lived in town. They don't even know exactly how to get from their dorm to the classroom buildings.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know exactly where Grand River Avenue is.
Right.
They certainly don't know where Frandor is. They're
sure.
they're lost.
Right.
And by the time they find Meyer,
right.
it's too late to register to vote.
Right.
And so they've missed the election.
Sure.
Well, it's just and the idea, well, you should vote here because, you know, we all affect you. Who is we? They don't even know what elected officials there are. They certainly don't know the names of those
sure.
people. It doesn't matter because the election is going to be held, and if we can politicize them
mm-hmm.
by November 5th,
mm-hmm.
we can grab them by the arm, we can take them to the early voting center,
right.
we can squeeze a vote out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So campaigns are going to find themselves very much reorienting themselves to people who are less settled, who are less... less educated, who have... a typical voter is married. A typical voter owns property, owns the home they live in, has a full-time job. Well, each of those things has a correlation with being a Republican. And they're not proof of being Republican.
Sure.
Obviously, lots and lots of people own homes and are not Republicans.
Sure.
But if you add all these things together, older, white, educated, married... homeowner, full-time work. You put all those things together, you've almost got, like the Republican model. Well, all of those things make it easier to register and vote.
Right.
Every one of those is correlated with a higher turnout and a higher, mm-hmm. higher probability of being registered.
Right.
Well, Prop 3 says you don't have to
right.
have a plan. You can have moved last month.
Right.
We don't care if you didn't register to vote on time.
Right.
We don't care if you don't own property. We don't care if you don't have a stable address.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And so it won't be a huge improvement for Democratic fortunes, but in a lot of little ways, it'll make it easier for Democratic candidates
mm-hmm.
and liberal campaigns
mm-hmm.
to turn out voters, to identify and politic among them
mm-hmm.
and encourage people to turn out. It also will mean for everybody that there will be less chance of getting snagged by the system.
So let me ask you, because one of the things that I noticed about this is when I was looking at some of the numbers, it looks like actually Michigan has a very, very high rate of voter registration already. But is that an incorrect statistic? Or?
Well, I don't believe in percentage turnout where you take a numerator of the number of votes and a denominator of the number of registered voters, because I know the voter rolls.
Mm-hmm.
The voter rolls have 7.4 million people on them.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 7.4 million,
mm-hmm.
2 million of them aren't there. Look, mm-hmm. I've looked for those people.
Okay.
There are 2 million people on the voter rolls, 2
mm-hmm.
million, not people, but 2 million records
mm-hmm.
of people who are dead. They're
okay.
just plain dead.
Mm-hmm.
Or they moved to Florida 10 years ago.
Right.
They're not coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There are all sorts of cases. We actually found one woman who had married and divorced and had a couple kids under different names, and she was registered to vote a total of 9 times.
Mm.
And so even when she votes,
mm-hmm.
she only has an 11% turnout.
Okay.
Because the other 8 of her failed to vote.
Right.
But she's carried on the voter rolls, and, you know...
So when we go to the Secretary of State's website, and it tells us that there are, you know, this percent of the population of voting age people is registered to vote, that's actually junk numbers.
It's just junk numbers. There mm-hmm. are about 5.4, it depends, there are some definitional problems, but about 5.4 million real people that if you went to the address listed by the Secretary of State mm-hmm. on the voter roll, mm-hmm. you'd find them.
Right.
Or at least you'd, they would have been there recently.
Sure.
There are all sorts of people on the voter rolls that if you go to the address, in many cases, the person who lives there now has never heard of them. They've lived there for 10 years, mm-hmm. and they've never heard of the name of the person that you're trying to turn out.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly there are many cases of people who've been gone for 10 or 20 years who are on the voter rolls whose moms throw away the mail from the Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
I know of such a case where right. they moved in 93,
right.
and they're still properly registered to vote right. 25 years later.
So you think this will really have a significant impact on the behavior that campaigns need to adopt in order to turn out voters that are different than the traditional voters that they're used to turning out.
Right, not just on election day, but also who they should target their literature to, who they
sure.
should campaign among.
Right.
That person who really is hard to pin down where he lives, you know, people mm-hmm. with bad credit, people who are right. basically don't have a lease in their own name but are kind of just mooching off girlfriends.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just imagine that category of marginal person, you know, has maybe a part-time job or maybe doesn't have it, is maybe enrolled for school but hasn't gone to class for a while. I mean, that person is normally just completely excluded from the voting,
sure.
right, in the political
right.
system.
Right.
And suddenly that person in a tight election mm-hmm. starts being a high priority target.
Right. And what from the research that you've been doing over the last many decades, what are the characteristics of those kinds of voters and where do you think they're going to end up given our current political landscape?
Well, the person I'm talking about, I'm sort of making a caricature of them by
sure.
by adding all the characteristics.
Right.
I mean, a person who most of the people who fail to vote or mm-hmm. are not on the voter list at the right address
mm-hmm.
only have one or two of those characteristics. But imagine somebody who moves in September.
Mm-hmm.
They could be a very stable, very good voter,
mm-hmm.
but they moved.
Sure.
And you find yourself in a new city in September,
right.
and you don't happen to re-register in time,
right?
And you're pretty much just out of luck in
right.
Michigan now.
Right. Well, right, right. Okay, so that's right. So there's a lot of people, even of the more traditional voters that we're used to seeing, that will also be affected.
But that person is more likely to be a Democrat because Democrats are more likely to move than Republicans.
Right.
That person is more likely to be a renter. And
right.
So... each of these things, they're mm-hmm. more likely to be a racial minority,
right.
more likely to be young.
Right.
Okay. So each of these things that makes it hard to vote in our current system is correlated with being a Democrat,
mm-hmm.
and that is why the Republicans have blocked all these mm-hmm. reforms. It's not because they really, in their heart, want to make it difficult for people who move in September of an election year to vote.
Mm-hmm. It's because they believe in minority rule?
Well, it's just that the current system works so well for them. And if you conducted a focus group among Republican officials and Republican activists, you would discover that they really believe that it's sort of immoral to make voting too easy.
Hmm.
You really want to make it a challenge. And if people can't meet that challenge, you actually hear this when you talk
yeah.
to them privately.
Yeah.
You know, if it's not a challenge
mm-hmm.
and you make it too easy,
mm-hmm.
the wrong people vote.
The wrong people. There's people that are wrong for voting. I think you and I would both agree that that's anti-democratic. The idea that anybody who is governed by the system shouldn't have a say in that government. I mean, from the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson wrote that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. And to me, that means if you're making it difficult for people, I mean, first of all, if we believe that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed, it's the responsibility of the government to go out and get that consent, not try to make people jump through hoops in order to give their consent. That's not the same thing.
See, you and I might agree with that, but
sure.
if I had a good Republican activist here,
mm-hmm.
it'd make him very uncomfortable. He'd point out that that, you know, you have a right to do lots of things, but some things require notaries and three mm-hmm. witnesses and a $20 mm-hmm. fee, and mm-hmm. you have to file it in person, and you mm-hmm. have to present ID. And I'm not even talking about voting here, but just
right.
transferring real property. And shouldn't voting be like transferring real property? Shouldn't it be like having a will? You know, you got to do it in a lawyer's office, and you got to do it on the right kind of form, and you got to record it somehow, and, you know, and this and that. And they just like formalities and technicalities because the wrong people don't end up voting, and you don't end up with wills that are sort of flaky.
That argument basically is saying that that if you don't. If you don't want to participate in that particular form of social organization that's based around these economic norms that they would, you know, that they have in their circles, some of which overlap with democratic circles, of course, and other circles. If you're not into, you know, that kind of wealth accumulation, for example, then. Then the process should be foreign to you, and you shouldn't be as easily you be able to as easily access the government that you're governed by.
I guess you could say that. I don't really see it as being an explicit. You don't have to be living on Walden Pond in order to be a Democrat. You can own a house. You can
sure.
be married. You can. Drive a car. You can do all those things.
Sure.
The Republicans aren't saying that you have to embrace capitalism. They just would prefer that the county seat be located someplace inconvenient, and that makes it. This is how the South ran elections for many years,
and is doing again now with the.
Yes, that's right. If the county seat is the only place you can register to vote, and the courthouse is closed, you know, mm-hmm. at 4 o'clock and is only open certain days of the month and so forth, that makes a great electorate because the only people who can ever register to vote are the ones who are already registered
right.
because they don't have to re-register. Right. You just make it a little harder. You just set up a few barriers. You just trip a few people. The whole process of restricting the vote is not what it used to be, where people were physically prevented from voting or threatened with violence. Today's system is just a statistical screening. It's just hard to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Why 5,000 or 6,000 MSU students succeeded in voting in East Lansing last week, but 30,000 didn't.
Mm-hmm.
Notice that the number of people who voted and the number of students at MSU who are U.S. citizens
mm-hmm.
are dramatically different numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the statistics. There are about 150,000 19-year-olds who live in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly how many of those are away at college, but I would guess about 30,000 of them are not living at home. They're living at college. Well, mm-hmm. of those 150,000 people,
mm-hmm.
4,000 of them requested absentee ballots. And 2,500, or let's say 3,000, returned their ballots in time to be counted.
3,000.
It's out of 150,000 19-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of those 19-year-olds voted in person, not a huge number, but mm-hmm. maybe 10 or 20,000. Some of those people weren't really interested in voting. Some of those people this, some of those people that. But when you finally get down to it and you realize that the system we've set up so far for registering to vote and getting an absentee mm-hmm. ballot tripped all but 3,000
mm-hmm.
19-year-olds in this state and prevented them from getting an absentee ballot and voting an absentee ballot, that's just pretty darn remarkable.
Yeah. Do you think the no excuse absentee will make a big difference? Because, I mean, I've known a lot of people who've just said, you know what, I go in and I say that I'm going to be out of town, and and I think that's a pretty common thing. Do you think that particular part of Prop 3 will have a big impact?
Well, we've seen it work in other states, and so we know that many people will start voting absentee. Now, it interacts with a piece of Michigan law that people don't know about,
mm-hmm.
that in Michigan, the clerk is permitted but not required to keep a list of people
mm-hmm.
to whom applications for absentee ballots are automatically mailed.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to be clear that they don't mail ballots to people, mm-hmm. but they automatically mail applications.
Oh, okay.
And so if your name is on the list of people to whom an application is automatically mailed, then it's like the old Book of the Month Club, which mm-hmm. probably none of your listeners will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But
they get wine of the month now.
I have a friend that has that. Where if you don't act, they send you a case of wine.
Right.
Okay? They sent you a book. Well, if you act by just checking it off and putting a stamp on it and mailing it back, the next thing that happens is a ballot comes.
Right.
And then if you mail the ballot back, you've become a regular absentee voter.
Sure, sure.
And all of the candidates think of you, John Smith, he always votes absentee.
Right.
Ever since, like, last election.
Right.
And then people campaign and knock mm-hmm. on your door and phone you mm-hmm. and mail to you, and you sure. automatically get an absentee ballot because mm-hmm. you send in the application.
Mm-hmm.
And then you discover, mm-hmm. see, this all interacts.
Sure.
If you start voting absentee and you have a ballot, mm-hmm. you discover it's like a hot potato. You mm-hmm. have to mail the ballot back
mm-hmm.
because it's the only way to get the phone to stop ringing.
That's
this
right.
Actually
yeah,
happens.
No, yeah. No, it happened to me this time. I was originally not going to vote absentee because I like going to the polls. But then there was some work around the election that I was asked to do, and so I went down and got the absentee ballot. And literally the next day, I started getting texts and calls and multiple of them. Turn in your absentee ballot. Turn in your the campaigns were pretty good about that. There were a number of them doing that.
And the campaign has the ability then to focus all of its attention on the people with the remaining ballots.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people who still have a ballot a week before the election.
Mm-hmm.
They really want to get rid of it because
right.
the campaign's got nothing better to do than bother them.
Right.
We already see this in Washington and Oregon State
mm-hmm.
because they conduct their elections entirely by mm-hmm. mail. There's
right.
no election day activity
right.
at all there.
Right.
And so it's sort of like a process of hunting down the last
mm-hmm.
absentee ballots to
right.
force people to vote them.
Right.
Like there ought to be a community
right.
celebration when
right.
the get-out-the-vote drive can cease because
right.
all of the ballots are cast. So they have very high turnouts.
Are there any things that – any ideas about how to campaign or tactics that work better in the system we're going to be in now that these propositions have passed that we can take from the other states – we should be talking to candidates and campaigns here about this is how you need to change what you're doing. Are there some ideas about that you can give us?
Sure. First, though, you have to think about that elections exist in a continuum from very interesting to very boring.
Mm-hmm.
And people work in very boring elections, but that you have to use different tactics.
Sure.
So in 2020, we're going to have a presidential general election. It's going to have a huge
yeah,
turnout.
Right.
And at that point, the interesting person is not going to be the name on the list. It's going to be the person not on the list.
Right, like you talked about before, sure.
Or on the list, but at a wrong address.
Right.
I mean, many of those 2 million people I talked about, they're registered to vote, just not where they're living.
Right.
So finding people who are not on the list
mm-hmm.
is going to become a new activity.
Sure.
Right? And trying to find out who among them is sympathetic and can be, mobilized.
Right.
Okay. So the presidential primary, which mm-hmm. is only, God knows, 15 months away,
right.
which people aren't focused on yet, but is, it's going to happen to us whether we're ready or not.
Yeah.
Same sort of thing. There'll be an interesting election, and there'll be, I don't know how many Democratic candidates, 5, 10, 20, 50, a busload. So a candidate there really... you wouldn't be working the voter list, although many of the people you'd be looking for will be on the voter list. What you're looking for is somebody who agrees with you.
Right.
Because if they agree with you, they can be made into a vote
sure.
by just getting them to an early voting site or a poll or getting them to apply for an absentee ballot.
Do you think that this will lead to better discussion of issues because there's a higher return on persuasion? Persuasion than there is on rhetoric.
Well, the discussion is quickly moving from a mass discussion to a one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the direction that digital media have
sure.
enabled, and so the world where people have discussions on TV
mm-hmm.
and in the newspapers, mm-hmm. and there's mass campaign literature, that era is coming to a close.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it's going to become increasingly necessary for candidates to campaign one-on-one,
mm-hmm.
which is very hard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing for Donald Trump to campaign to individuals, identify his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a probate judge in Muskegon County,
mm-hmm.
and you're running for re-election and facing a difficult re-election campaign,
mm-hmm.
how in the world do you find 80,000 people in Muskegon County to talk about probate judgeship?
Right.
They don't want to talk to you. They don't right. care. They don't know what a probate judge is.
Right, right.
So whether this improves or reduces the quality of the discussion kind of depends on what office you're talking about, what kind of election. Many of our elections are really low key.
Sure.
We forget how many city council elections, school bond issues. So
right.
not everybody's running for Congress.
Right.
A lot of people are running for county clerk.
Right, right. And so I think that what you just said means that we really have to have a much stronger organization behind candidates in order to be able to make those kinds of voter connections efficiently. Does that make sense? Or?
Well, it would, except you're trying to tell that poor probate judge in Muskegon County he's supposed to build a big organization.
No.
It's just him and his wife and his secretary. What do you want him to do?
No, that's what I'm saying is that organization, you know, political organizations, whether that's the Democratic Party statewide or locally, or whether that's activist organizations from progressive organizations or organizations that are, you know, like the ACLU or something like that, where there has to be some organizational infrastructure that candidates can tap into in order to make those kinds of arguments. And the group, broadly speaking, the group that figures out how to make those organizations accessible from the bottom up is going to be more successful in this new environment.
I guess that's right. I guess that my mythical Muskegon probate judge is going to have to start showing up at community meetings and working his connections, but still nobody cares about him. You see, Michigan elects so many offices.
Mm-hmm.
We don't realize how many elected officials we have here. We have
10,000 or something like that.
Yeah, over 10,000. We have layer upon layer. You know, who serves on the Court of Appeals today?
Mm-hmm.
God knows who's on right. the Court of Appeals. There are 24 of them. I could probably name four of them off the right. top of my head, maybe six.
Right.
And I'm probably as knowledgeable as almost anybody.
Sure.
Well, who's on the circuit bench?
Right.
I can name all seven of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'll bet that if we interview 1,000 people out there,
yeah.
not another right. person can name right. seven circuit judges.
But this is exactly why I think those kinds of organizations that I was talking about, whether it's the party or the local progressive organizations, or like I said, the ACLU, et cetera, the marijuana legalization groups that are going to be working on other projects, et cetera, all of these groups are interested in that. Because of the impact that, for example, local judges have over what happens in, with the way that the new marijuana laws get implemented and enforced, and there are other aspects of law that impact groups that have particular agendas like that, and I think what you just said is more emphasis on the need for that kind of infrastructure. Do you think?
Well, for some, but what about if it's not an issue in the campaign? A probate judge doesn't have sure. much to do with marijuana.
Sure.
You know, he's just trying to run for re-election. And,
right.
and for some reason, we elect all of our judges in this state, and we elect judges in obscure positions.
Yeah.
And he's got to run a campaign.
Sure.
We've got 500 school districts.
Mm-hmm.
Hell, in 400 of them, there's never been a seriously contested election.
Right.
But by God, we make them file for office. We have elected library boards in this state.
Yeah.
We have elected road commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
We have drain commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
We have probate judges. We have, you know, we've got community college trustees.
Yeah.
One of the greatest reforms would be to elect fewer offices,
mm-hmm.
have, you know, more executive power, appoint some people to mm-hmm. things like police chief instead of electing sheriffs.
Mm-hmm.
But by God, we never do that. Michigan is so much into elected officials. And so many of those people, in the past, they have gone and bought a voter list, and they put mailing labels on them, and they've sent out bulk rate mail, and the hope was that people would get the mail and vote for them. And now people aren't even reading their mail.
Right.
People have stopped looking in their mailboxes because it's full of dreck.
Right.
And that poor probate judge candidate, you think he's going to get active in organizations. I'm telling you, we're going to end up with probate judges all over Michigan who are named Kavanaugh and Kelly. And if they aren't named Kelly today, they can change their names to Kelly and get elected 11 years from now when they no longer are listed on the ballot as formerly John Rippendell, right? And they just, no, his name is John Kelly.
Right. So I think that you're identifying two different groups. One group that's not ever going to be engaged, you know, for whatever reason.
Right.
Okay. And the other group is people who are going to be engaged at some level.
You're talking about the candidates now.
I'm talking about voters.
Well, but yeah, but so, all of us, no matter how engaged we are, we don't care about probate judges.
Right.
I don't. I know the probate judges, and I don't care.
Right.
Okay. I know the LCC trustees. I voted for them, and I barely knew who they were.
Sure.
I defy you to name the candidates for LCC trustee in the most recent election for whom you voted.
Samantha Wilbur.
And?
I actually don't live in the area, so I know Samantha Wilbur because I know that...
vote for two elections.
Yeah, I know.
Well, that's wonderful. You knew one. Okay. I'm just telling you.
She's a strong progressive, and I know her from the organizations that I'm talking about.
Okay.
Which is again, why I really think that, you know, the problem that you're pointing to is that we have a very different landscape of information and informational environment than when you first started in 72, as we were talking about before the show with punch cards. And we have an informational environment where one of the key factors is that most people are really overwhelmed by the fire hose of information that's available. And so you have to, they have to find some way of filtering them. One way that they've filtered for a long time has just been by party identification. But right now we're in this period where a lot of party identification is becoming more fluid. There are a lot more, there has been for decades increasing numbers of independents. Despite the fact that those independents generally also, you know, lean one way or lean the other between the two parties. And the key question, I think, going forward is how do the politically engaged from, you know, candidates and local activists communicate with the people, the voters, who are not necessarily that engaged? And I think that... I think you're right. I think that there's an awful lot of stuff that we've been doing so far that is becoming less and less effective, for the same reason, in a certain sense, that if you have the same smell in your house for a while, you don't notice it. That there's so much of this stuff going on, and people just start tuning it out. And so to communicate with them on a level that gets action, I think that you need to have that one-on-one. You can't do that one-on-one as a candidate very well in this environment. You need an organization that will really draw people and go out to people where they are to make that communication, whether that's knocking doors or, you know, having events. Am I making sense here that there's a different way that we need to communicate, and it's going to come down more to human level, and to do that, you need organizations?
Well, you can talk. I agree with you, but I think that I want to take this a level deeper.
Please.
In the first place, talking about what we need to do doesn't get it done.
Sure.
And many of these people, I'm just telling you, can't do it. Right. So we're going to end up with people in political offices who are just stranded because what's happening in America, not just in politics, but in all of our lives, is that the mass society is breaking down. This is like a really deep point. 50 years ago and 100 years ago, you could address people by using the media, and the media was a method that you could just plain tell people things. The radio and then television, you could actually just force people to listen to your message.
Mm-hmm.
In 1960, it was possible to buy all three networks, an ad at the same time, and because there were only three networks and mm-hmm. everybody watched network TV,
sure.
you could basically just plain tell America something, mm-hmm. whether America wanted to hear it or not.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy advertising, and people had to watch advertising because they watched TV, and
sure.
TV was all commercials.
Sure.
That sounds like I'm talking about television only, but I'm not. I'm talking about everything
sure.
that people, because of the change in technology, and I'm not just talking about computers and digital media, but all sorts of changes, power is shifted away from the mass organization, from the mass seller,
mm-hmm.
politics, retail, whatever,
mm-hmm.
and people are building around themselves their own world.
Mm-hmm.
So people who only care about Canadian rule football
mm-hmm.
just watch Canadian rule
right.
football.
Everybody lives in their own bubble.
And people who only care about porn just watch porn all day.
Right.
And people who are obsessed by cooking, they do nothing but watch cooking shows.
Sure.
And they don't have to watch it at the time the show is advertised, is mm-hmm. run.
Right.
They DVD it. They
right.
they TiVo it. They
right.
They watch the cooking show they want, and it may even be a particular obscure cooking show,
sure.
and you are the only person in Michigan
sure.
who cares about that form
right.
of French cooking.
Sure.
We live in that world, and as a result, the person who wants to tell you something that you don't care about has no way to talk to you.
Right.
Now, you think all these people are secretly all signed up as progressives or conservatives
no,
or something.
I don't.
Well, the point is, If we got 10 million people in Michigan and a million of them are signed up in some progressive organization and a million of them are signed up in some mm-hmm. conservative organization,
sure.
the question is, what about those other 3 or 4 million voters?
Right, right.
And you think, well, we should just sign them all up.
No,
but they don't want to. They want to talk about French cooking.
No, no, I agree. I'm not
and
saying
there's
that. I'm not,
nothing,
I'm not.
There's nothing that I can do as a county commissioner
mm-hmm. right.
to get their attention. The whole world is breaking down this way,
mm-hmm.
and taxi cabs and Meijer
mm-hmm.
and the cable TV
sure.
companies and the city government, we all wonder how to get people's attention because they don't read their mail.
Right.
They don't watch TV. They don't subscribe to newspapers.
But I agree with you. I think you've misunderstood what I was saying about these organizations. I'm not saying that we're ever going to be able to sign all these people up. For
but
one organization or another. Right.
The problem
sir,
is that
so let me, let's, no,
the
I,
5
I,
million people are going to vote,
right.
and of those, 80% are people who are not connected to any of the organizations you want to create.
So here's the thing is I'm not saying that they necessarily have to be connected to a particular organization or a particular group of organizations. I'm saying that we need organizations because the people who are engaged and want to be part of that organization have connections to people who don't. And the way that we're going to have to reach people is by those kinds of personal connections rather than by the mass media like you've just described. We can't reach them that way clearly anymore. And so I think what I'm arguing is that not that these organizations are going to draw all these people in or that we're going to have this massive recruitment of all of these people into these organizations. I'm saying that we need an infrastructure from which the people that are engaged can have a way of getting good information clearly and consistently and have a plan among them to go and reach out to their neighbors and their friends and their family that are not engaged in the same way that they
are. If you try to talk to your neighbor
mm-hmm.
about the probate judge candidate, you will never be invited to another neighborhood picnic. Okay?
Mm.
The neighbor doesn't care about probate judge. You probably don't care about probate judge.
Mm-hmm.
The probate judge is the only person who cares about probate judge. He and his 3 staff people and his wife and kids and 10 lawyers.
We elect him anyway. Right. I agree with you about that. And I think that there's an interesting discussion to be had about how many of these should be elected positions as opposed to appointed, as you were suggesting before. But my question is, other than that kind of networking that I've described, what are the other options for connecting with these people?
Well, how about not connecting is the problem. I think an option is where we're going, which is not connecting.
Okay.
I think that what's happening is that the system that we've had is breaking down
mm-hmm.
we elect 7,000 or 6,000 township and city board members,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
How many people in this state know anybody anything about township government?
Right.
Nobody. And
very few.
I mean, yeah, and I mean the ones who live there, because townships and cities are so small.
Right.
I mean, it's a good example. I've been
sure.
talking about probate judge, but the average person in this state lives within 1 mile of a boundary.
Sure.
I mean, how can you care about living in Sumter Township if you're 8,000 feet from another township? And
right.
when you buy a house, you're probably going to move across the township line.
Right.
Why do you, you're not dedicating your life to Sumter Township.
Right.
You don't really care about Sumter Township politics.
Mm-hmm.
But Sumter Township demands that you vote in their elections when because mm-hmm. it's held at the same time as presidential election.
So my question is, what do you think the solution to that is?
I don't have one. I'm telling you that it's just the whole system's breaking down.
Okay.
We're going to end up with party is actually becoming more important because it's one thing. See, when voters vote, they bring very little to the polling place other than general feelings about big names.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of have a feeling about Republicans and Democrats. They probably mm-hmm. have a feeling about Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Sure.
They probably even have a feeling about Debbie Stabenow and Mike Bishop.
Okay.
But that's about where it fizzles out.
Sure.
The other 30 or 50 names on the ballot, they don't have anything. Mm-hmm. So what one thing that they bring is they bring the ability to read and see Democrat or Republican
right.
or judge of probate court
right
on the ballot.
Sure.
And so the ballot informs them. On ballot proposals, the language of the ballot proposal actually determines how the thing will do.
Mm-hmm.
It matters very little what the campaigning says.
Sure.
What matters is what is printed on the ballot
mm-hmm.
because the voter shows up and struggles with that ballot. So increasingly, offices that are partisan,
mm-hmm.
we're seeing an increase in partisanship, not a reduction.
Mm-hmm.
This last election, partisanship shot up. Not
mm-hmm.
down. It's not declining.
Mm-hmm.
For other than that, we're going to see ethnic stereotyping,
mm-hmm.
even though that's beginning to break down in society. If you've got nothing to work from except that you've got three candidates for LCC trustee,
mm-hmm.
and you can look at the names and say, I think that one's black,
mm-hmm.
I think that one is Hispanic,
mm-hmm.
and I can't guess what that one is,
mm-hmm.
well, depends on how you feel about blacks, Hispanic, and people mm-hmm. of indeterminate race, or
sure.
how you feel about women or men.
So I agree that right now the trend is that people are using broader identifiers to drive specific choices.
But they're doing it at the polls. Is
right.
what I'm warning you is that
right.
they're not doing this through great research and so on.
Right. No, I completely agree. So actually, let me use that to ask a question about going back to the statistics in this election. How much of the Democratic gains here in Michigan do you think are due to, for example, the campaign that the one campaign, as they called it, that they ran, that the state party ran. And how much of it do you think it is due to, you know, basically those larger national issues that can be that are often categorized in the way that you were just describing by ethnicity or race or gender or political affiliation, et cetera?
I hope I don't have to choose one of those because I don't think either of those was important.
Okay.
What was important was this guy with orange hair in the White House.
Okay.
He made recruiting candidates easy. He made raising money easy. He made it easy to get voters whipped up and practically hysterical. And, you know, if he just stays in the White House forever, we will finally wipe out the Republican Party in this state. But
mm-hmm.
he won't be there forever.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to eventually have to, you know, take responsibility for running a government.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Democratic Party... And I speak as a Democrat who's been involved in these campaigns for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Democratic Party is incredibly inept.
Mm-hmm.
I think that its competence is not high, and it may even be declining. I've been involved with a couple of professors at Yale University who wrote an academic book called Get Out the Vote, which is studies of Get Out the Vote techniques, it's actual scientific studies with control groups and experimental treatments
mm-hmm.
and serious statistical treatment. And you know, I'm referred to in their book maybe a dozen times mm-hmm. because I've co-authored papers with them.
Sure.
And what I've noticed is that absolutely nobody in the Democratic Party is interested in anything that is testable.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in the Democratic Party is willing to spend any money at all on proven techniques as opposed to what they believe works.
Mm-hmm.
What really matters to people is what somebody's brother-in-law heard somewhere,
mm-hmm.
what the guy at the Union Hall says worked really well back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way we always do it, is mm-hmm. the phrase that really runs the organization. The only thing that saves us is the Republicans are almost as bad as we are.
Mm-hmm.
The level of technical competence is very low. I mean, what I was just talking about, where, you know, there are 150,000 19-year-olds in the state. Of them, about 60,000 are registered voters and can be identified as Democrats,
mm-hmm.
I mean, or Democratic-leaning, mm-hmm. okay, from modeling that we do.
Sure.
So what effort was spent to get those people absentee ballots or turn them out?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, well, there was a national flyer that was produced by the Democratic National Committee, and it was mailed to them all at their parents' addresses. You say, well, but they were away at college.
Yeah.
Well, but that's not the address on the voter file, and you wouldn't want to bother actually doing any work.
Right.
So the way you do it is you'd buy the voter file, which is really cheap, and you'd spend a lot of money on each piece because they're very high-cost, glossy, mm-hmm. beautiful brochures with pictures and all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
none of which has ever been tested and shown to work.
Right.
And then mail them all absentee ballot applications, in spite of the fact that they aren't living at their parents, they're living at college.
Right.
Now, you could have phoned the parents one by one, tracked down the names of mm-hmm. kids who were away at college,
right.
gotten cell phone contact information, done a lot of work, but that would be work.
Right.
And the Democratic Party, I think also the Republican Party,
mm-hmm.
believes in collecting the low-hanging fruit over and over again long after the low-hanging fruit is all picked.
Right.
So, I have a number which I've proposed in the past, which I believe is right. How much does the Democratic Party spend per additional marginal vote
mm-hmm.
that they turn out for the party?
Mm-hmm.
They say, if you spend X dollars, mm-hmm. you get one more Democratic voter mm-hmm. to turn out. You know what that number is?
What is it?
$1,000 a vote.
Wow.
It is $1,000 a vote because these people are so incompetent.
Wow.
That all they do is they piss away all the money they collect because they use techniques which we know are invalid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The guys at Yale, and again, this is Alan Gerber and Donald Green,
mm-hmm.
have put together all these very well-conducted studies. And one of the things they've done is they've looked at robocall GOTV methods, right?
Okay.
And they've assembled the results, last I knew, of something like 1.5 million
mm-hmm.
GOTV robocalls. And officially, the book says that there is zero evidence
mm-hmm.
out of 1.5 million calls comparing treatment group to control group
mm-hmm.
that they turn people out. But I talked to Don Green about this, and I pointed out that my analysis of the table is that probably GOTV robocalls reduce turnout slightly.
Mm.
And he admitted that was his guess, too,
mm-hmm.
that the more money you spend on this, probably like one person out of 5,000 just plain throws up their hands. If you make 5,000 calls, you convince one person that they're just not going to bother.
Right.
Okay? And so how much money did the Democratic Party spend on GOTV robocalls this mm-hmm. year? Quite a bit is the answer, because it's
right.
so easy. And it's low-hanging fruit, and you don't
right.
have to do any planning,
right.
and you don't need any structure,
right.
and you know, you could just do it, and that's the way we've always done it.
Right.
And you say, could we please call parents one by one,
mm-hmm.
find out if their kid is away at college, get the contact information, do this like a month before election
mm-hmm.
day, so we have plenty of time to do this.
Right.
Talk to the kid away at college. Many of them will turn us down. Many of them already
sure.
got a ballot. But one by one, we work them, and we try to turn out not 3,000 Democratic voters among 19-year-olds away at college. Maybe we can get 5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we turn out 2,000 additional voters from these 60,000 people that
mm-hmm.
I'm guessing exist, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we finally squeeze out 2,000 voters at $1,000 per marginal vote. we could spend $2 million on that.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't cost $2 million to get 2,000 extra voters.
Right.
So I try to pitch this, and you know, nobody returns my calls.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because I'm too stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's because they already know everything I know.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe it's because it sounds like work.
Mm. That could very well be. I'll tell you that I have personally experienced people telling me that you're calling too much. Because you're calling too much, and I'm going to get ticked off about it pretty soon. So I've had that experience, and I absolutely believe that you may very well turn people off, because I've actually had people tell me that they're getting turned off.
But if you spend your time tracking down the parents of a kid who's away at Berkeley,
mm-hmm.
and you say he doesn't have an absentee ballot requested now. Could you give me his contact information?
Right.
You go to the Berkeley website. Maybe you can search there for UC Berkeley.
Right.
Maybe they'll show you his name.
Right.
Maybe you can email him. Maybe you can phone him.
Right.
And it would be one at a time.
What I find interesting actually is having done some research on you before the show, you're used to doing that work because back in the day when you wanted to run those punch cards, to get the data, you had to go to a lot of these local clerks and get the physical voter lists and take photographs of them and things like that in order to get the information because it wasn't computerized. So you've lived through that period where you had to do a lot more work up front in order to even be able to do the simple things that are done now. And now you have some of those simple things that are done without doing much work, and technology has changed again, and now you're back in the point where you have to do a lot more work to have the same kind of impact that the technology that came in the 70s, 80s, and 90s has already given us.
But we don't need to schlep data the way
I
did.
Right, it's a different kind of work.
The work is actual interpersonal, one-on-one, what you were talking about before, but I don't think we can do it through organizations because the organizations aren't structured to get me. You see, the person I care about with Get Out the Vote isn't the person who is active and interested.
Mm-hmm.
The person I care about doesn't care.
Right.
The perfect voter for me is somebody who just wants me to go away. And if I can set this up so the easiest way for them to get off the hook is to sign up for an absentee ballot, to get the absentee ballot, to vote it, to mail it back in, and then I'll leave him alone.
Right.
That is my ideal person because he would not have voted but for my intervention.
Gotcha.
And so my intervention has paid off with him.
Right.
So I'm not interested in talking to interested people, right?
Right. But that's what I'm saying is that I'm saying that you need the organizations that I'm talking about are people that can do the kind of work, organizations that can do the kind of work that you're talking about.
But, okay, but we have to understand that our target is the person who is clueless.
I agree.
Our target is the person who doesn't care.
Yes.
Our target is the person who moved last month, moved here from another state, doesn't know anything about Michigan politics.
Right.
Maybe they're a Democrat and a likely voter in Indiana.
Right.
But here they are living in East Lansing because they just started a faculty position at MSU.
Sure.
And that's exactly my target person.
Right.
Right. Well, it takes me a lot of work to sift down to him.
Sure.
And sending him a boilerplate, you should vote. Voting is important. Voting is very important.
That's not
what I need. What I need to do is say, do you know that in Michigan you're eligible to vote even though you've only lived here for 3 weeks?
Right.
Because the election is still more than a week away, so you'll have lived here more than 30 days.
Right.
So you're eligible to vote.
Right.
Now here's how you do it.
Right.
Okay. One person at a time,
I
turn out one voter,
and
we should get my volunteers, the Democratic Party's volunteers. If we each took on two or three targets and got them to vote, we could have turned out another 100,000 or 200,000 Democrats. So the answer to your original question is, how big an impact does the one campaign have? Well, it sure spent all the money, and that was probably important because otherwise the money would be lying around where it could be embezzled. So I guess it was a good thing that they ran the campaign, and I'm sure it didn't hurt anything.
Mm-hmm.
But
they didn't get the value out of the money.
They keep picking up the low-hanging fruit. One of the things I'll just tell you another of the sorts of things I've tried to propose. There are trailer parks all over this state.
Mm-hmm.
Now, trailer parks have very low turnout
mm-hmm.
for many different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, if you hired somebody who mm-hmm. lives in the trailer park,
sure.
who is a known likely voter,
mm-hmm.
in other words, and almost all trailer parks have several people live there
sure.
who vote all the time.
Right.
Right. And they would just work their neighbors,
mm-hmm.
and you paid them,
mm-hmm.
and you worked with them, and you encouraged them,
mm-hmm.
and you got them a list of the people who were targets.
Mm-hmm.
Could we turn out 10 additional voters
mm-hmm.
from every trailer park in Michigan?
Sure.
And well, I don't know if the answer is yes.
Well, let me tell you why I say yes. I say that because I know several organizations who specifically targeted trailer parks, not necessarily because they were targeting trailer parks, but because they realized that there was a bunch of there were a bunch of people there that are voting age. And they went there. I know that they went to collect signatures, and they got lots of people to collect signatures to sign, you know, petitions to put people on the ballot. And they had conversations with these people where it became clear to them that these people actually are interested. If you talk to them, if you go to their door and say, "Hey, we're out here because we think that this is important, and we want to talk to our the people in our community about it," there's a lot of people out there that are very receptive to that. This is what I'm saying about organizations, is that it's not about getting people to join the organizations. It's about getting the people in the organizations to do the work that you're talking about, because we're not seeing that from the Democratic Party or from other places. And we'd like to see that from the Democratic Party and other big organizations. And, I think that's one of the things that we have to keep working on, both within and outside of the party, to try to drive those changes that you're talking about to turn out more and more voters.
You're seeing more progress there than I did, because I've asked questions like, "Do you have a list of trailer parks in the state?"
Mm-hmm.
No.
Right.
"Do you have a list of people in the trailer parks who are known voters?"
Mm-hmm.
No, they don't have that.
Yeah. No. Do you know?
For example, how the addressing system works
right.
in a trailer park.
Right.
So you could even canvas door to door there.
Right.
Do you know how many units there are?
Yeah.
I mean, this is a database I tried to build.
Yeah.
Nobody's interested in this database.
Okay. I'm interested.
Well, okay.
I'm interested, and I'm interested in all of these different ideas that you're talking about, and I'm interested because I think you're right about a lot of it, and I think that there are organizations out there that are interested and can do it. We just have to put that information together with the right people, and sometimes that means getting the right people into the right positions. We have to wrap up here. I'd like to have you on again to talk about some of this more in depth. There are a couple of philosophical things that we sort of left on the table before, and I'd like to discuss that with you as well, and talk more about the statistics. So thank you very much, Mr. Grebner, for joining us here today, and I look forward to having you on the show again soon.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody, for watching. We'll be back next week with another episode.